When I was doing all of this hunting around, I went to one of my professors in the statistics department, Paul Switzer, and he gave me a few books by professional skeptics. Here's a list of what the skeptics call the downfalls of the psychic trade. 1. The experiments are not repeatable. 2. There is the possibility of fraud. 3. Improper mathematical methods are used. 4. ESP is logically impossible. 5. The evidence has been misinterpreted. 6. ESP's existence has no relevance to organized science. And 7. The experimental designs are inadequate. And I realized that while some of these objections have to do with method, a lot of them are not logical criticisms, but emotional charges or value judgments. And programs like PEAR often receive this sort of criticism even when their studies use methods borrowed from experimental psychology. So I started wondering, what if PEAR met the skeptics' methodological conditions, and they still weren't permitted into the halls of science? I began looking for somebody else who was trained in rigorous scientific research and who was also studying the paranormal. I found just the right person. Stay with us. When I was in the midst of this project, I read an article in the San Francisco Examiner that featured an interview with Dean Radin. Dean has a background in electrical engineering, and he started his career at Bell Labs and then later worked for several years at the Stanford Research Institute studying psychic phenomena. I thought maybe he could help me take the next step. I contacted Dean and recently had the chance to visit him at his current headquarters at the Institute of Noetic Sciences in Petaluma, California.
In the lab here, we have, this is primarily used for psychophysiological studies. You can see over here, is one of our boxes that we use for that sort of thing. This is designed mostly to measure autonomic measures, but also you can measure central nervous system. Things like the parasympathetic and the sympathetic branch of the nervous system. Autonomic, so-called, because it's operating automatically, like the thing that's making your heart beat and breathing and that sort of thing. In contrast to the central nervous system, which is what your brain is doing. So we use that because if we're doing an experiment, for example, in the unconscious equivalent of telepathy, if two people feel so deeply connected that that they feel each other's emotions and they somehow know when the other person's going to call and so on, it suggests that in some way they're connected. Even though they appear to be separate, they're connected or they're together somehow. So we're standing in front of a Faraday cage, or an electromagnetically shielded room, which is 2,000 pounds of steel, and it's solid steel. So when the door to this room is closed, I wonder if you can pick up the sound of this when it's closing. Let's see. It probably just makes a thunk, that thunk, and then gets pulled in. So that squeaky noise was actually sucking the door in to make an electrical seal. And now to get it open, I have to really push against it. There we go. The reason we go to such extents here is because this is part of an experiment where two people are isolated, and we want to see whether or not they're able to, quote, communicate with each other, even though they're isolated. And so one of the two people has to be in a condition where no ordinary form of signaling, electromagnetic or otherwise, can get to them. So the whole chamber is actually sitting on a mat, a vinyl mat on the bottom, which is a vibration isolation as well. And then we're sitting, the whole floor is concrete. So once you're in that chamber, from there to the room about 20 meters away, we've tested to see what kind of audio leakage there is. And basically, it's way below even our ability to unconsciously pick it up.
So there's no communication from this chamber with the outside world.
Right. But nevertheless, the idea is to see if the people were connected by some means which is not electromagnetic and not vibration, not sound, not anything else, how would we detect that? So the way we do it is, if you come in here, you know, inside the chamber, typically we ask the person in here to simply relax. We'd have a reclining chair in here. We wire them up to look at their heartbeat, their skin conductance, their brain waves, a bunch of things, and simply ask them to relax. and to keep their partner in mind. So they know their partner's going to be somewhere else. They don't know where, but somewhere. They don't even know what the partner's doing, but to just keep them in mind continually. And what we have in here then is a closed-circuit TV camera so that the TV will get the picture, the face of the person in here, and then take it outside through fiber optics and route it to the other room. So now the person who is in the room, which we would call the sender, although they're sort of sending their intention, their job is to mostly sit in front of a blank TV monitor, and every so often the monitor will suddenly wake up and show the face of their partner who's in the room we're currently in. And when that happens, to mentally try to connect. Even though both people are keeping each other in mind all the time, when the image pops up, it's their signal to mentally try to connect as much as they can. And so this happens randomly 36 times over the course of a half an hour. And nobody knows when these periods are going to be. Even the experimenter doesn't know. Also, the receiving person inside the box, their physiology is continually recorded, and the same in the sender. We have their physiology recorded continually as well. So the hypothesis of this would be that if the two people are connected in some way, even though we don't see how the connection is done, that when the person who is the sender is given a startle, which is the picture suddenly popping up, that and at the same time they're using that startle to provide some energy to try to mentally connect with the person over here, we know that their body is going to go through a large sympathetic arousal, and we see that in their body. But then the anomalous question is, what's happening to the body of the person who is in here? If they respond at about the same time and showing similar kinds of physiological arousal, at the same time that their partner is actually trying to send something to them mentally, then it provides evidence that at least at a physiological level that they're connected somehow. So that's the kind of experiment that we've done many, many times. The null hypothesis would say that the person in the shielded room here, since they don't know what anybody is doing outside and they don't know when or anything else, there shouldn't be any systematic correlation between them and the outside world. But the fact is that there are correlations between.
And what are your correlations like? What are your findings like thus far?
Well, the last experiment we did simultaneously measured skin conductance, fingertip blood volume, heart rate, respiration, and one channel of EEG. So five measures continually in both people. In all five measures, we see that there are correlations, unexpected correlations, by chance anyway, appearing in the receiving person's body in correspondence with the sending person. The strongest correlation, one that's easiest to see, is in skin conductance. And so we tend to use skin conductance a lot because it's a very easy measure to take. It's all of these are non-invasive, but it's easy to put on, it's easy to take off and all that. And it gives a very nice and sensitive measure of what's going on in the sympathetic nervous system.
Keeping in mind what I'd read of the skeptics, I asked Dean how strong the correlations were, and I also asked whether he had enough data to verify the data's statistical significance.
Well, in terms of the magnitude there of the correlation, it's pretty small. But because we have a fair amount of data, we have lots of couples involved in this and take a lot of data in the sessions, statistically it's clear that something is going on. And in these experiments, it's not that unusual to get probabilities of less than 0.001. All of these experiments suggest that whether it's a telepathy experiment or this is called DMILS, the acronym means Distant Mental Interactions with Living Systems. We also do clairvoyance experiments, precognition experiments. Mm-hmm. All of them suggest that our sense of being isolated and separate in both space and time is an illusion, and that we actually are connected through space and time in ways that we're only just beginning to understand, but that we have a fair amount of data suggesting that that is true.
Dean is a rare breed, like the professors at Princeton. He's a professional scientist who developed an interest in the paranormal later in his career. And unlike a lot of sort of woo-woo mystics out there, he was coming at these problems with a very strict empirical point of view. and I asked Dean about his time at the Stanford Research Institute, where he was part of a team conducting research about psychic phenomena. This research was funded by various intelligence agencies of the U.S. government.
The amazing thing about working at SRI was I felt a little bit like I was transplanted from a Bell Labs environment into basically the same kind of technical and scientific environment, except that people were entertaining things which from the outside were considered to be impossible or worse. And I had enough trouble in the previous 5 years in reconciling my training against the possibility that psychic stuff was real. And I wasn't working with highly trained people. I was working with myself and people in the laboratory. But so one big difference at SRI was they had the opportunity to work with and find, specifically go out and find people who were extremely good, natural psychics, mostly in the realm of remote viewing or clairvoyance. And you don't need to witness really good remote viewings happen very often before you understand why this idea that we don't need proof-oriented research anymore. We really don't. But the question now is, how does it work? How do we make it better? From the reason it's being funded by the government, or was funded by the government, is that it seemed to be useful for intelligence purposes. And that's what most of the focus was on.
One of the things that kept coming up in these interviews was the potential case of fraud. Maybe the people who claim to have evidence of ESP are simply lying. The possibility was mentioned at Princeton, with Professors Longino and Switzer, and again with Dean Radin. I asked Professor Longino how to prevent against fraud, and this is what she said.
You know, scientists think they're trying to get at what's real. And if something is, the idea is that if we're talking about a genuine phenomenon, then it's going to be manifest whenever a similar, the same setup. If it's manifest in one setup, then it's going to manifest in the same setup when that setup is someplace else.
The best way to prevent against fraud in science is to independently replicate an experiment's results. I asked Dean Radin what he does when it comes down to the question of fraud, and this is what he said.
You do the same as you do anywhere in science. You have to rely on independent replication, because you have to rely on the integrity of the people making the claim, and you don't know. You never know. I mean, there are people publishing articles in Nature and Science, which are found out to be false after a while. And the only way that you eventually find out is by what other people come up with. It's replication that does it. That's the self-policing. So in the case of the Princeton work, had anybody else replicated a similar kind of experiment, or even exactly the same experiment, independently? And the answer is yes, both before the program started and after. So in context of a larger body of people doing similar experiments, the fraud hypothesis doesn't wash. In fact, their results aren't bigger or even more repeatable than what other people have reported. They fit very nicely within the larger body of data. And if you can show that a result that somebody is reporting is not an outlier among the rest of the data, well, if it's fraud, it was a pretty stupid fraud because it didn't make it any better than anybody else. And now you have to go to a sense of group fraud, or collusion among lots of people. And once you get into that kind of paranoid state, you basically might as well just give up, because it means that a sense of open-mindedness is no longer there.
Another key question in this discussion is about the nature of consciousness. I thought this might be a relatively simple question to answer. We're all conscious. It seems like we'd agree on what that means. But it turned out to be a lot like that original question about gravity. Nobody knows what consciousness is. There are a lot of theories out there about what consciousness is, but none of them have yet to be verified. This is what Longino says.
In psychology now, there is certainly a good deal of research on consciousness. Now, this is on human consciousness, but we can probably learn a lot more about consciousness just from studying ourselves, both in the psychological context and also in what's called neuropsychology, trying to understand the relation between psychological phenomena and neurological phenomena. I think once we understand more of that, we'll actually have more of a handle on what the concept of consciousness actually is. I think part of the problem with a lot of this research is that the idea of consciousness that's employed is, in a way, almost metaphorical. So it's something like my consciousness, but if I don't really have a good handle on what that is, then how can I sort of be talking, attributing consciousness to something that I have no way of actually accessing?
Dean Radin also had an interesting idea about what consciousness is and how it fits into a quantum model of the universe.
I don't know. Nobody knows. I flip-flop on this issue. I understand the power of the neuroscience explanations. We're getting really good at explaining the circuitry of the brain. And it's easy to become seduced by the power of these explanations into thinking that the brain is a kind of computer. And if it's a kind of computer, as far as we know, computers don't have ESP. So game's over. So there has to be some other explanation. You can come up with, you know, a whole bunch of explanations, none of which I think have any merit, but nevertheless, if you really need those explanations, you can latch onto it and assume that that's true. But the reason why I reject the computer metaphor, or it's not that, actually it's not true, I don't reject the computer metaphor. I reject the idea that we know what material is like. We know the nature of physical systems to such a degree that we know what its actual boundaries are. And there, I think we don't know anything. We're as Newton said, I think, that we're little boys playing with stones on the edge of the ocean. We've just begun to understand a little bit about the nature of the medium in which we live. And the brain is no different. So if it turns out that the brain as a quantum object with enough recursion built into the object is sufficient to give rise to what we think of as awareness, I'm perfectly comfortable with that. It becomes kind of a reductionistic, materialistic approach to understanding consciousness, which is the prevailing idea in neuroscience. But it also says that whatever that machine is, it also has some other peculiar properties. And some of the other peculiar properties are that we feel particulate most of the time, but maybe we have a wave-like character as well. And maybe it only comes every so often because you need to be in a weird sort of coherent brain state for this to exist. But when it does exist, we have access to information all over the place.